So I would like to welcome everyone again to this fifth talk in this series on using death, embracing death for our spiritual practice, as our spiritual practice. And what we're doing, I think there are lots of euphemisms for death. And the euphemisms soften the blow, don't they? Like I just read one where the Dharma is full of these other words that we can offer it, like stillness. It means exactly the same thing, but it doesn't carry the impact. Doesn't arouse the same inward reactivity as death does. So I like to go to the sharp word. I like to go to the word that creates the most, the greatest rigor scale, you know, like 9 on the Richter scale. You think I would know that in Seattle, wouldn't you? It's the rigor scale, by God. because I think that where we react is where we're in hiding, where we are most vulnerable. And I want to find out where that is for myself. I'm not trying to force you into that same... I guess I am by bringing but not... I want you to each take it on as you see fit for yourself. But I like the word death because it shakes virtually everything and doesn't give the ego a hiding space. Silence, stillness, I can hide behind that. I mean, I can be very comfortable with that, can't I? And some of the other ways that we frame and paraphrase the reality of what we're trying to do. But in any case, what we are trying to do, we are calling forth something. And now we have to do this from, there's a certain reverence when you call forth something spiritually, like we are asking death to come forward. It will. Now we're not asking to die. I mean, that's not physically. I mean, we're not, it's not that sort of calling forth, but we're calling forth the intention towards a topic. And when we do that, the universe responds. There's no question. And so we have to be very clear that we want this subject to meet us. And some of us would rather kind of take a parallel road to this subject and handle it from some distance. So you're certainly welcome to do that, but these topics go right into it because there's a lineage within Vipassana that uses death for its main focus of insight and understanding. And it's a very steep climb, as we've been speaking about it all these weeks. Tonight, I want to show the evolution. When we call forth death sincerely, the mind will develop a relationship. Death will come at us, and there will be some transformation that occurs through that interaction. And there are a series of stages or phases that we go through when we call out like that. And I want to go through the phases of that evolution when we do that. But I want to start back up a little bit. We had a retreat out at Cloud Mountain this weekend. Many of you attended, and I always appreciate seeing those and having a kind of a renewed relationship with people who have attended, and I appreciate that. But one of the women who was there, who's not here tonight, from a different city, was in a group, and she mentioned, she's a long-term sitter, I've known her for many years. She said recently a good friend of hers died. And it's affected her retreat. I said, oh, are you mourning? And she says, no, no, I'm not mourning. Not as being the central focus of the retreat. It's like, what's the point now? What's the point? And you see, it had thrown her into disarray. The subject, death, had disturbed her. She was, and which she willfully admitted, she was into, you know, sort of doing this for self-beautification. And many of us have that as our central issue for meditation, a quieter mind, a calmer spirit, a more focused attention, a more kindly interactive style or whatever. But if when she was faced with the death of a friend, she saw that style died with her. You see? And so she was, her whole practice, focus, and intention was thrown into disarray. She didn't know how to come back together so that she could make it meaningful practice. Now, I say this for each one of us here, to look in our heart as to why we practice. Because we can practice an awful long time, for many years, and perhaps the entire length of our practice, without taking on the depth of the meaning of which the practice descends. And to think of it as a kind of, a character formative practice. And in its heart of hearts, it will defeat you when we have taken on an alternative purpose for it. It will defeat us every time. So it's important to know what it is, to look deeply for the intentionality, why we practice. What's the point? The spiritual search is the search to end death. And spiritual awakening is awakening to what creates the conditions for the existence of death. The Buddha left home because he saw death. That was his search. He says, my God, if this is the inevitable result of life, not just for me, but for all beings, then I have to leave home because my life isn't serving the resolution of that end. What we begin to understand, and this will probably take you some time to really understand, but the beginning of it, I think, is already upon us, that death is self-imposed. We do it to ourselves. Because we have taken residence in that which changes, instead of that which does not change. And when we do so, the inevitability is that we will die. We have harbored ourselves into our own individuation, distorted reality to fit that perception. And when we do so, by fracturing and distorting something that is basically whole and together in itself, then we have to objectify the experience of reality rather than abide within it. And when we objectify that reality outside of ourselves, we have made it certain that reality will change and that we will change and die. Everything will die in accordance with that particular configuration and display. So real death is the release of the I-thought. And that sense of objectifying reality as being outside it's funny because enlightenment is perception without distortion, not seen through the lens of the ego. The egoic state is the altered state of consciousness, the one that we habituate. The one that we take as our usual and normal perception. That is the altered state. We see the way we want to see. We see duality where there is none. There is no separate lives out there. That's a distortion. We give life to each thing like a bird. There is no separate lives out there. It's already dead in that sense. Nothing was ever alive individually. That was just the way we thought about it. But when we deny life through avoidance, we create individuation where there isn't any. And then those individual things die. So spiritual practice is really recovering from that distortion. Since the false dies, let us look to see what does not die. That's the Dharma pursuit. And we can also look in terms of our meditation, because most of us weigh in on how well we're doing in meditation by what experiences are occurring within that meditation. But enlightenment itself has very little to do with any experience whatsoever. In fact, it has nothing to do with any experience whatsoever. In fact, it has to do with that which allows experience to even be known or be seen. Not the experience, not the arising of sensation. Not what do I see, but what allows seeing to take place. When we invest in what we are seeing, then we're invested in the life and death and struggles of that experience. But we invest in the seeing itself, not in what is being seen. The seeing itself, that does not change. And so we learn by first, most of us through our birth, through our early childhood, have learned to infuse the world, invest in the forms, the expressions of it, expressions, the experiences of life, the body, the sense of me, the sense of you. And spiritual practice is the divestment within that. Christ said, do not lay up your treasure where rust doth corrupt, where thieves let in. That's what he's saying. Don't invest in the forms and expressions of life, because they die. They get taken away. They confuse you as to the point and purpose of why life is unfolding as it is. And when we begin to see and become disenchanted with the forms and expressions of life because they don't hold the promise. They don't fulfill the promise that we thought that we had invested in them. Then energetically, our desires and fears don't go out to those forms any longer. And where the energy then goes is in the seeing, is in the awareness. That which makes the eye capable of seeing, not what the eye sees. That which makes the ear capable of hearing, not what the ear hears. So as we come closer to the moment, we first come very close to death. Because as we come close to the moment, we begin to notice, you can't get close to the moment without noticing that the forms and expressions and senses and experiences of that moment are in constant rapidity, moving, changing, flux, transition. But there's another component of that moment, of this moment, that has never moved. But if we are recoiled within the sense of me and the protection of the sense of me, we will be too fearful to experience that which is everlasting. Because we'll be recoiled with the fear of losing ourselves within the moment. So we take separate transitory life for everlasting life. Meditation purposefully, meditation when it's done in the right way, allows experience to die. As we sit, we don't encourage the continuation of anything. When somebody has a wonderful experience and wants it back, the teacher, if oriented in correct alignment to the teaching, will suggest that they release the need or expectation to have that experience back. And when any experience arises within meditation, no such big deal. It's no big deal. It doesn't signify anything. It doesn't acclaim anything. It doesn't proclaim progress. More so is how one invests in it. What is one making out of it? How is one substantiating that experience towards some kind of truth? Because it's in that investment within the experience that will inevitably die that they are arresting their true progress, which is divesting from experience entirely. What is left after everything dies? That's the spiritual quest. What is left? When we sit down and everything is moving and changing, why would we want to take claim on any of that? When it's impossible to get it back, it's like standing on an earthquake fault and building your home as it's actually quaking on the Richter scale. What is it that does not die? What is it that holds all experience as we sit? And as we begin to sense that, because it can't be sensed through the senses, because what is sensed through the senses is in transition. Sight, sound, smells, tastes are just movements. but that which holds all of that and lets that be known, that is not in movement. So now we're going to move in to calling death forth in our life. Like one wolf's call in the wild. And you hear it, and there's this little sense of exhilaration and also a little trepidation. When you genuinely listen to what the universe is about in its raw state, there is both joy and exhilaration and a little trepidation. So when we're out on the mountain peak and we say, come at us, death, just come at me. We know that this could be a major earthquake. And it does. It does come at us. In fact, I thought I was leaving. I knew I wasn't, but you kind of wish you could leave the subject by leaving the profession of hospice care. And if anything, it has followed me further. It doesn't let go. Once it bites, it doesn't let go. It's another way of saying this. It keeps coming until you enter it. We enter alive into death. So we're using death as a teaching. And when we call it forth, it will. And it will start getting closer to it. Start drawing us nearer. If we're genuine, sincere, it'll bring us closer to itself. And so what are the phases? If we stay open to each phase rather than to recoil and protect ourselves from the stages, then one stage will pass and move into another. And the stages are not so that they're separate, discrete things. We will circle back to stage one even when we are well into stage four. And this movement of circling back is kind of for forever because our minds are changing the understanding of what this moment is and about, and our orientation to that also changes. And so we circle through these stages again and again. But usually you can find yourself predominantly in one as a major component of the teaching. And they're both a natural progression and also a volitional intention. Those homework assignments, you can bring forth each of those stages willfully and with intention and volition and just focus in on that perception of life that that stage contains. And you will start working with it like that. And that's a fine way to do it too. But it also goes naturally, organically, on its own. It pulled me through. So what is the first stage? First stage is one we've mentioned before in other talks, but with a little more depth, the stage of self-preservation. The first stage is the realization, not the knowing, not the intellectual knowing, but the realization. It's like this woman on the retreat, realized. That's what she was really saying. I just realized something I hadn't realized before. And now my practice is meaningless because I had based it upon knowing it but denying it. But now she let it in, and it changed the way she practiced, and changed her, and she had to find new motivation for why to practice. So too, when we actually rub up against it and know for certain that this body and mind, this organism, will die, then it will change virtually everything and everything on our plate. First, we'll get angry, if we're honest, because we will consider death a mistake, a flaw. and that the fountain of youth was the right way to go. And so there's a kind of bitterness and disappointment can lead to despair, that this rub, when this rub occurs, how it occurs. And there's also an egoic contraction, one of two ways. We can circle the wagons and become more careful in ourselves, more safety conscious, drive slower, you know, look both ways, all of that sort of thing. The things we were told in kindergarten, but now we're actually doing them. Or we can explore. And what's very important is we can shut off the continuation of the theme at any time. You can cash in your chips and fly into denial, if you so wish. So, we feel this fear, and as any good meditator knows, and we have a room full of them, fear is deception. I'm not going to live my life with fear because it's a deception. I'm sorry, when I'm afraid, I look at it. And if you don't have that intentionality, where you been? Because that is an indication that something's missed here. It's a distortion. It's not true. And so if I'm believing in a fear, I darn well just sit up straight and say, come on, let's look at this thing now. Not, maybe not pleasant, but I have to do so. And very quickly, fear can move into a belief for resurrection. It can move into a belief. You can be so afraid, you can say, well, you know, when I die, there'll be heaven. Heaven will save me. It wants to move to a conclusion of safety. And so, but I won't let it do that. And I hope you won't either. Because that's purely fictional. Just creating a belief out of fear is just to assuage the fear. It has nothing to do with the truth of what the fear is supposed to be based upon. I want to see whether the fear is based upon a truth or not. So with that tenacity and with that courage, we set going on this thing. And we don't shut our eyes to it. In fact, we want to open up even further. We look for roadkill. We see the different manifestations of death in ourselves because our mind is constantly dying and birthing. Ideas are lost. Emotions are in movement. Everything. We won't have to look far for the basic rub. And that takes us, evolves us, a step closer, not further away. See, death is coming in now. It's coming in with an impact, and the fear that we feel is the fact that the presence of death is close. And it's all based upon that distortion of reality, of myself and other things, this and that. When there's a this and that, the this is going to die and so is the that. And what death is trying to do is to bring us back together again. But we have to go through the misery, the absolute terror of the this dying or the that dying or the me dying, to have the motivation to come back together. You see, it provides the motivation. It provides the focus for intention. It provides the focus for both intention and attention. And that's why it's such a captivating subject. It holds us to it. You can't turn away when somebody's dying in front of you. You can't turn away when you see that you're life is as fragile as the leaf that's just fallen from that tree. So it takes us into the second stage of the evolution, and that is the stage of the universality of death. The universality of death. Now, let me just go back to the self-preservation. When the self-preservation unfolds, so do our activities when we start moving them towards the resolution of this fear, which is just holding the fear and not accepting the fear as the conclusion. We want to start finishing our business. Time becomes precious. We want to finish our business. We don't want to leave a lot of leftovers on our plate. There is also an encouragement to be more present, because we see that everything else, we just lost ourselves. So to re-own ourselves is a priority in the stage of self-preservation. And there's a stronger sense of appreciation for life, a deep gratitude for the life that I am living, even as short as it might be. So this stage, although filled with the horror of the mind's opening to something it has so long denied, has tremendous benefit. Tremendous benefit. There are benefits and insights in each of these stages. So the second stage, the stage of the universality of death, now the ego is still very much alive in these first two steps, and it becomes very... makes death very important and special. And, you know, when I was a young hospice clinician and I went out to a patient's home, I wanted to, let's spend our time now really meaningful and talk about death, right? But they never wanted to. The patient who was dying, I wanted to, because I thought it was the only topic of any importance. I didn't want to talk about anything else. So I was kind of obnoxious, because you, as any clinician will learn, let the patient lead the conversation, and you don't try to force them into a topic that they have no intention of going. But the egoic sense of importance, you know, death is the most important thing. Now, you know, don't save your chit chat for later, because this is the topic. Exaggerates it, doesn't it? It's not any more important than anything else, but it makes it important because it's like, it's got the thing. It's got the special teaching. This is the secret teaching. So I'm speaking from personal experience here. But then, you see, as you start seeing that it's not personal, that it's a completely impersonal process. I mean, it's personal, but it's also completely impersonal. It's not just me that's dying. It's everything that's dying. There's a kind of way that we lose our meaningful relationship with life, what the woman was saying on the retreat. It's like, what is everything I've wanted has been based upon things not dying, upon the assurance of my continuance, the purpose, meaning, intention, everything that I, the acquisitions, the havings, all of it. And so there can be a moment here in which it can feel very dry and desert-like. What's left? Where do I go to drink the source of motivation? What do I do here? And that can be very bleak. And because there's no joy in life at that moment. We're trying to figure out a new posture to things. And it's not coming through easily. And in that case, and that can take anywhere from just a few moments to a prolonged period of time to go through that, depending upon how much we get stuck in trying to reshore up our old life. Because that's what happens, is we try to make the things that are no longer meaningful still meaningful. And meditation, you probably have come to some of that through just your connection with stillness, death. It's like the old things just don't, I just can't, I want them to be back enriched, but they just are, they don't have any life in them anymore. And so what happens when we don't try to infuse a new orientation to life with new meaning, if we just let it be despairing for a while, what happens is that there's something more that comes out of us. The posture becomes oriented towards generosity, towards connecting, towards compassion, because we see the pain of death and we see the universality of death, and our heart is drawn out in that relationship, in that contact, and we feel the pain of the universe, the endless sorrow of all life, because it's in the same conditions that I'm in. It holds the same conditions. You begin to see what holds life. What are the laws that hold life? And so there's a different side of us comes out and meets life. It's not the intellectual side. It's not the side of trying to make myself into something I can never be again, or trying to enrich myself with status and possessions, because all that has died in the universality of death. But if we don't fall into despairing and we just hold steady, a different component of us arises and meets life. And suddenly it has meaning for its own sake, for the moment that it's lived, not for some accumulated or not for some product orientation, but for the quality of the moment that is lived. That's its meaning. And we also realize that death cannot be fought. There's no fighting this. And so no longer raising a struggle or an outcry or a damnation. It's a mistake. Without that, we fall into the next phase. We fall into the next phase, which is the stage of letting be. Now, the heart has been open to pain from this stage of universality of death. At this stage of letting be, it's the organism itself, the mind itself, is start acquiescing to the nature of life. And the stage of letting be is the stage of releasing the need to control. Because you let things be. When there's the fight is gone, that's what's left. It sounds like defeat. I've been defeated. The sense of I, the sense of me, the egoic sense of me has been. It's lost its contest with death. But the awareness grows proportionally to the diminishment of the sense of me. So something else that's rising out of me has tremendous energy, tremendous aliveness. Not a despondent me who's now realizes that I'm going to die and all things are going to die, so I might as well just start digging my grave. But something comes out in tremendous energy, energetically. And we find life is being lived as a verb, not a noun. Active, creative, spontaneous, alive. No need to try to control or fixate. Well, beautiful story. This talk may go a little longer, so I ask for your patience. There's a beautiful story in the Buddhist tradition of Gotami, who is a young mother who has a child, and the child, after a couple of years, dies. And she's a mother with a single child. And she goes to all the healers at the time, and the healers say, well, there's nothing we can do, the child's dead. And she refuses to believe that. And finally, the healers send her to the Buddha. And the Buddha looks at the child and says, I can heal that child, but Gotami, you need to go to a house in the village and find me a mustard seed, because this is the ingredient for me to be able to cure the child, a mustard seed from a house in which there has been no death. And so Gotami, very servant, with very rightfully goes to each home, knocks on the door, and says, has anyone died here? And the people at the house say, of course, because people are living in extended families. Of course, many people have died here. And she goes into house after house after house. And it's said that after a number of these homes, she realizes that her child has died, the stage of universality of death, and goes back to the Buddha and asks to become a nun, and to surrender, letting death be, and ask for a proper burial of her child. Surrenders. That moment of surrendering the child up is that moment of letting life be. Letting life be. And there's also an understanding at this stage of the value of suffering. Because we've seen it in ourselves. And you don't take suffering away from somebody so quickly just because they're suffering. Because you see it as the driving point for their spiritual journey. That the suffering is the way, is the crucible, it's the struggle with suffering, that we come out into the glory of relaxing, of letting be. And so you understand suffering in a completely different way, having just gone through your own in relationship to death. And we also understand the definition of growth as being very different. That one cannot compel growth in another person or in oneself. There is a readiness factor. And that a good healer will just create an environment for that person to grow in the way he or she needs to grow, rather than in some compelling force trying to pull something out of another. And there develops at the same time an honesty in yourself to say, no, I'm not ready for this. And to honor that. I'm not ready for it. And I wish I were. It'd be great, but I'm not. So that's it. So we come to a kind of honest relationship through having gleaned and sharpened our honesty through this subject. It also, though it may not express itself very well through me, leads to a much more patient human being. Because you're letting things be. A more patient listener. Because you have nowhere else to go but to listen. Which is the only reason we're poor listeners. Life has allowed its way. And the sense of I becomes less important. Because we're finished with that expression of ourself, or near the end. But it's still there. It's still very much back in there. There's still division at this stage. And time we're not time bound in the same way anymore. Because something with our relationship to death has ended. We start living time. Living time as an expression of life. And our heart begins to move in mysterious ways. There's a beautiful story of an Alzheimer's patient who had Alzheimer's for 12 years to the point where he could not recognize his family or speak coherent sentences. And he was in the dining or in the living room with his two grown sons. His wife was fixing dinner in the kitchen. And the Alzheimer's patient falls over and has a heart attack, very close to death. His sons, one grabs the father and cushions the blow to the floor. The other son says, "I'm going to go call an ambulance." In a voice that neither son had heard, this is a true story, for 12 years, the Alzheimer's patient says, very distinctly, "Do not call an ambulance. Tell your mother I love her," and then dies. The power of the heart. The bow. The power of the heart. That's the stage of letting be. Not fighting the death, but moving with the power of the heart. Final stage. I'm leaving out many stories. Is the stage of personal inquiry, because at some point the residue of continuance, of permanence, gets sniffed out. It's like everything is now in complete abiding agreement of death, except one component where I hold a particular sense of permanency in myself as I look out upon life, releasing it more and more to be itself, but me not joining it. And that, for the heart, is unacceptable. And so it's a natural turning, a natural, organic question of who dies, who's dying, what is this thing? Trying now to come to the ground of life, rather than to just move through it more easily. Discovering the ground. And as we get quieter within that discovery, the ground is known. And that is the deathless. The Buddha equated nirvana. Sometimes he would call it the deathless, that which death cannot touch. Once known, never forgotten. And everything else comes back in. Hi, hello, how are you? Fine, nice to see you. Have a safe ride home. But everything is different forever. And the path and phases of death have been resolved. And the only way that death can be resolved, where death cannot touch, which is the direction that our practice points. And it's my wish for all of us to know the deathless. Can we sit quietly for a minute or two? So sitting quietly means allowing what is there to have its life, to have its expression, and also to end. We don't need to follow a thought. We don't need to invest in an emotion or a memory as meaning anything more than just what it is, in simplicity. So know, let us know our way, even if death is not going to be the main focus. Let silence do the same. Ask, intend it to come into your life. Ask it, call for it, like a child to his mother. And it will do the same.